we swapping it out for local because it's what matters at this point. Karen Hollerly, representative from the Child Witness Foundation. Karen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, Karen, the Cape Argus noted a shocking verdict of two educators from South Peninsula High. They were acquitted of sexual assault charges, but this dates back over 20 years ago. So the reports indicate the attorney representing the one educator successfully filed a Section 174 application to have the matter dismissed. So the victim essentially brought this case forward many, many years later. So obviously we don't want to focus on this particular matter, but sexual assault committed by educators, you know, who are essentially in charge of minors. These are not, by the way, incidents. There are so many. And can we imagine for how many years so many victims have perhaps remained silent?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It is a big issue. And I mean, you know, we talk very much about the fact that sex offenders exist in all shapes and forms and all areas of life. Those who work with children and prey on children, we refer to as career perpetrators. So they identify areas where they will be able to access children. And it's a global issue. It's not just one in South Africa.
Now, what about the impacts of this type of situation? In this case here, Karen, the victim only brought the case forward many years later. That also quite common because the victim literally lives in fear, is pretty much worried, concerned. What would the community say? What the ramifications and the knock-on effect this may have, you know, for the future or her current circumstance. But, I mean, just trying to put yourself in the place of this particular victim and many others who take so many years to eventually come forward and speak up.
Yeah. I mean, we have to look at the dynamics of abuse of children, particularly sexual abuse cases. And we need to understand that it's a much broader issue than just the act of the sexual assault itself. And that's what we try very hard to bring into the courtrooms as we try and tell the story behind it. And that story is what actually contributes significantly to trauma and what really puts barriers in place for people to report, particularly where there is some form of dependency or there is a power imbalance between the victim and the offender or some dependency by the victim on the offender. You know, these kids are targeted for a particular reason. We know very much about grooming, how grooming is used to identify gaps in children's lives, and then those gaps are fulfilled by offenders, and then they transition that process of what looks like kindness and genuine affection to one of manipulation, exploitation, and abuse. So we have to understand the story behind it, and those stories are vital to being able to come to justice for these kids, because it's not an easy crime to understand. Cases of violence against children and women are not perfect crimes because they do have those elements of grooming. They do have developmental issues that children have that they don't understand necessarily what's happened to them, which causes delay in reporting and can also contribute significantly to trauma impact. So the story becomes crucial, the context in which the violence took place. And those are really big factors that we've been fighting for years for those types of issues to be heard in courts, because that is what makes people understand these crimes.
So we can't be talking about a perspective of where it's an educator who is in a position of authority. They're being trusted by the school community. They're being trusted by parents, by the learners themselves who are minors. And then in the same breath, also children being sexually abused. Oftentimes, and some of our communities, we do not want to talk about this, but we have to, the abuse is being perpetrated by a known family member. Yeah. Again, abusing the trust that should be existing there.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the statistics are very clear that over 80% of victims of violence are assaulted or sexually abused by somebody that they know. That's very well known. And that, again, goes to the grooming situation. So I think, aside from abuse of children happening in families, abuse of children happening in schools is probably one of the worst forms of abuse, because you, exactly as you said, you have a position of trust. It's a place that these children go to every day. It becomes a home away from home. It's a place where they grow up, where they develop, where they become who they are as people. And if that environment is destroyed and damaged through abuse, then you can imagine it's going to have a significant impact on what should be taking place, that development, that child finding out who they are. A lot of those processes are halted, or they are twisted, or they're damaged irreparably. And that is where we see the long-term impact, is that those traumas, that break in that child's growth process is what they take with them into their future. And without significant therapy, without significant support, without being believed, that is something that will damage them for life.
Something that you're mentioning here, absolutely crucial, Karen. Mm. Some victims have even argued over the years that the post-traumatic stress, the anxiety, the depression, the emotions that become so completely unstable after many years. Many of these victims actually reference those experiences either being equated to the actual abuse that they experience, or in some cases even worse.
Yeah, I think what people don't understand is, again, it's always compared to the perfect crime, you know, where, you know, somebody steals your handbag or steals your car or breaks into your house, which also results in trauma. But we tend to try and measure these types of cases against those types of cases, and it doesn't happen. So what happens in an abusive situation is that there are layers of trauma. So there's trauma that is immediate at the time. Some of the impact, we talk about something called tonic immobility, which is the victim's inability to move. It's almost as though they're trapped, like a deer in headlights. That impacts on memory. They don't want to look at the offender in the face, so they look at other objects like mirrors or clocks, or listen to sounds outside of the abusive environment, because that keeps them grounded and sane. So that's your first layer. You've got your physical responses. You've got your shaking, your nausea. All of those things happen immediately. But then down the road, other traumas come out. So then you start having the shame, the guilt, the more long-term mental impact, psychological impact, behavioral impact. And then we start to see behaviors that we don't really like. So these are kids who then start becoming aggressive. We see kids becoming sexualized. We see kids starting to take drugs. And then even further down the line, you see those patterns of behaviors replicating in future relationships. And there is a link between gender-based violence and childhood adverse experiences. So we know that. You see it in juvenile offenders. Children are not born evil. Something in their life has broken them to the point where they don't care what they do, and they don't care about consequences. So all of these are really knock-on effects. All the layers need to be understood. They need to know that at a different stage in a victim's life, something may trigger the trauma to come out. They have been fine, they've been functional, and then something happens that just reminds them or takes away their strength and puts them back in a place of vulnerability. And these are processes that are reoccurring. So at each stage of those trauma experiences and behaviors, it is important that our victims get support and that they're understood for why they need to have support at each of those stages.
So in conclusion, Karen, where we are right now as a country, are there sufficient mitigating strategies in place to ensure the accountability aspect of the perpetrator, and in the same breath also focusing on our learning institutions, our schools, our universities? We've even uncovered so much of abuse within our judiciary, high-ranking judges and judge presidents, etc., even still being investigated. But do we have enough of these strategies to ensure the accountability aspect is there, and in the same breath to provide adequate support to the victim?
So, you know, the whole issue comes down to the fact that this is a multidisciplinary responsibility. And in order for us to prevent violence against children, we really need to look at each of the different role players responsible for ensuring that that happens. And from our experience, so that's families, that's the child themselves, that's education facilities, healthcare facilities, that's government statutory services, the courts, all of them, each one has a role to play in moving us towards the goal of eliminating violence against children. And a lot of the first step to do that is about training and understanding. And it's got to be continuous because we know systems change, people move on. So that's a very vital point, is understanding. Because I think, as I said to you right at the beginning of this conversation, child abuse cases are very different from normal crimes. And we need to understand the story. So we need everybody to understand the story. So that's families. That's the children themselves, understanding what happens and how people feel when they've gone through abuse. That's educational institutions, understanding how to identify. Because, as I said before, a lot of the behaviors that victims show are not very nice ones. So people tend to discipline as opposed to understand. And that blocks that ability to communicate for the child so that they can get that story out and get the support that they need. Training for the courts, training for the police, training for all of those different systems. But similarly, there needs to be a support system. There needs to be, in an educational institution, for example, at least a person that explains to the children that they are available if they need to come and talk to them. And in a way that is somewhat confidential, because we know that not all these things can be confidential because of mandatory reporting, but there needs to be that person, that or a group of people. We see a lot of benefit in actually also strengthening children to be there to support each other, because we know from the research that a child's first disclosure is often to a peer, because you know, adults are adults, and children feel much more comfortable talking to each other. So, you know, we know that there are lots of safeguarding policies in place. We know that there are brilliant laws, there are great, you know, standard operating procedures for these types of things. But when it comes to the on the ground, knowledge and services become the most important weapon against continuous abuse.
Karen Holley, representative from the Child Witness Foundation. Thanks so much for joining us on PM Drive on Voice of the Cape.